Item number one, continuation of the public hearing to consider an adoption of the Shasta Watershed Temperature and Dissolved Oxygen TMDL. And it is the time to check my reading skills. This is the time and place for a hearing by the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, North Coast Region, to consider the proposed amendment to the Basin Plan for the Shasta River TMDL Action Plan for Dissolved Oxygen and Water Temperature and TMDL Introductory Language. This item has been properly noticed. A sheet explaining the procedures for this hearing is available at the handout table. Will all those who expect to give testimony in this matter please stand, raise your right hand, and take the following oath? Oh, boy. Do you swear or affirm that you will tell the truth in this matter? At this time, thank you. At this time, we will start with the staff presentation.
Today, Board, is our second hearing on the TMDL for the Shasta River. As you requested, we amended the draft document to include all errata from the last board meeting. We have re-noticed the documents and received 22 comments, and you have our response to comments. Holly Lundborg will be the first staff person up, and she will summarize the comments and responses along with additional recommended changes, with the exception of flows. The major issue covered in the second comment period was flows, and flows were included in this TMDL because cold water flows are needed to achieve the temperature standards in the river. Matt St. John will briefly review the technical information that led us to this conclusion. Knowing that flow was a vital piece of the puzzle, we examined the legal options available to the board for including flow in TMDLs. Samantha Olson will cover the options we examined, review what is currently in the draft, and discuss some proposed language aimed at clarifying the intent of the Basin Plan language. David Leland will conclude the staff presentation with a discussion of potential options for achieving increased flows in the river. If the board chooses to adopt the plan today, we will begin developing a work plan to implement the TMDL, and I would anticipate the work plan would be ready in draft by October. And like the Scott work plan, we will share the draft with stakeholders throughout the Klamath Basin prior to finalizing it. With that, I turn it over to Holly Lundborg.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Board. Holly Lundborg, lead in your planning unit. Slides for me. Kat's basically given you an overview of what we are hoping to accomplish today. I am going to be starting with bullet number one there, talking about the summary of response to comments. Next slide, please. Just as a brief reminder, at the May 17th board meeting, you directed us, your staff, to provide a clean copy of the action plan, the resolution, and the staff report incorporating all of the previously recommended changes. You asked us to do this to provide a clean copy for both the public and your review. You also, as part of that direction, closed the public hearing portion of your consideration on all except for the items that will show up as revised changes, things that you, the board, recommended at the meeting, things that came out as part of the public response, or part of regional board staff's editorial review. We did, however, extend the day one extra day because June 18th fell on a Sunday, so staff made the determination to extend comments through the 19th, so we accepted all comments that came to us through close of business on the 19th. We did, in fact, receive a number of comments that day. We reviewed all three documents, again with the idea of providing an A1, very clean copy. We made a number of editorial changes, and you will find those in strikeout and underlined versions of both the staff report, the action plan, and the basin plan language, I'm sorry, the resolution language. Those documents were posted on the web on May 26th. We received 22 letters of comment from a number of agencies, interest groups, and the private sector. We received comments from the federal agency NOAA, from the county boards of supervisors in both Humboldt and Siskiyou County, from the local RCD, from a number of fisheries groups, from farm interests, from watershed groups, environmental coalitions, and last but not least, private individuals took the time to write to you themselves. As Kat let you know, the majority of the issues that we received comment on were related to flow.
Oh, no, I didn't.
There were, however, a number of issues that were related to implementation and a few other what we're considering miscellaneous categories. A number of these were outside the scope of the comments that you directed us to respond to as part of your May 17th motion, but staff made the decision that both as a courtesy and to make sure we fulfilled all of our legal requirements, we responded to all the comments that that came to us. And with that in mind, with that workload ahead of us, we prepared a document that you have in front of you, I hope, that's about 40 pages in long, titled Response to Comments, Appendix K, and we'll add that to our staff report when we finally put the final posting up. Can we back up for 1 second? Well, the other thing I want to talk about briefly is the fact that we do have another errata sheet for you today. This one is much cleaner. There are three items on it. Samantha Olson, as part of her description for flow and her presentation, excuse me, on flow, will go over two of those errata changes, and I'll cover the third one in my presentation in just a minute. So the implementation, we basically broke up the categories into flow, implementation, and others just as a way of managing our workload internally. So these are our kind of our headers for them, but we were comfortable with it. A number of commenters, two or three of them, reaffirmed the fact that you, the board, and us staff needed to be committed to the TMDL. We were able to reaffirm that we are all totally committed. It is a top priority. Comments came in about reportable milestones, monitoring, and enforcement. Some of the comments, I think, were particularly on enforcement came in before folks had realized that we had stuck in the additional conditional waiver language prior to the May 17th language, so I think those were kind of old comments. Some people asked for shorter reporting time periods. Others asked for longer. Under ranch and riparian, this is where the third errata sheet change will come in. The farming community, the RCD community in the Shasta River had asked that we change the action plan, and that will be on, well, it's on the strikeout underlined version of the action plan. It's page 9. Paragraph 4, last sentence, we would replace the phrase Shasta CRMP and add Shasta Valley RCD, its CRIMP, or the Coho ITP permit process. Oh, excuse me. All right, David has just pointed out to me there was an additional one that I should cover here that was under tailwater, and it's that's again the same language. The local community asked us to add the phrase or through the CDFG Coho ITP. And just so you know, the RCD is going to be the permit holder for the RCD, so it's sort of a clarifying language, doesn't change the intent of anything that we've done. So those will be the three errata items that you'll see on your sheet. Couple of comments came in about Lake Shastina, again on time frames for studies and additional considerations for part of the study. We think the language was written both broad enough and clear enough that those issues will be addressed without any change. Basically the same with timber harvest and grazing. We feel comfortable with the existing processes in place, both through the THB process and the conditional waiver and general WDR that you've affected for timber in that area. Grazing, the same thing, with the caveat that if there are issues, we will ask for a ranch management plan that would address it. Finally, the Wairika waste treatment plant, we were given suggestions on basically asking us to direct mode of compliance. We didn't feel that was within our purview, and so we asked them to have that conversation with the Eureka plant themselves. Next slide, please. Finally, the last issues that came up, and again, these are outside the scope of what you actually noticed, but because we people took the time to write, and we found the time to respond, we decided it would be appropriate for us and for you to have these laid out. One of the issues that came up in a couple of comments was the link between Dwinnell Dam and the lack of Fist Passage and the upper watershed. We responded that, yes, we felt that it was important for both the Water Board and Fish and Game to be involved, and we intend to coordinate with them. Issues relative to public trust and your responsibilities, we feel that you are aware of your public trust responsibilities and that you're taking them very seriously. Some requests to consider focusing the TMDL on coho. We've elected deliberately to focus on salmonids in general. Volunteerism is still in front of us as an issue. Some saying, please continue it. It's important to make it work. Others saying it's not stringent enough. And finally, issues related to pH, temperature, DO, and nutrients, and how they relate with the model and the processes in play. Those were also given responses in our comments, but again, we really feel that the focus of your direction and our focus on response to comments was the flow issues. And so with that, I'm going to turn over for the technical presentation to Matt St. John.
Thanks, Ollie. Chairman Massey, members of the board, and members of the public, good afternoon. So I'm going to briefly summarize the our findings of our technical analysis for the TMDL with a specific focus on the role of flow in the temperature TMDL. And in consideration of the role of flow in the Shasta River watershed temperature TMDL, I think it's really important to study the wording of the narrative temperature objective for our region, as it is stated in part on this slide. But really, to boil it down, to summarize, our regional narrative water quality objective for temperature requires that there be no alteration of natural temperature, or alternatively, it allows alteration of natural temperatures as long as beneficial uses are protected to the satisfaction of you, our board. So in evaluating opportunities for compliance with our temperature objective in developing the temperature TMDL, our main analytical tool was the Tennessee Valley Authority River Modeling System model, and we went over this in more detail in the workshop and at the previous hearing, so I won't go over that again. What I will say is that the model was developed to represent and simulate temperature conditions as well as dissolved oxygen conditions in the Shasta River from the outlet of Dwinnell Dam to the mouth of the Shasta River flowing into the Klamath River. Shown here is the results of the baseline condition for our critical condition, which was a simulation period in late August of 2002. And we compare this to, shown in the dashed line, is the 18 degrees Celsius, which is the salmonid juvenile growth and rearing temperature requirement as developed by US EPA in 2003 in a document that was provided guidance to development of temperature objectives in the Pacific Northwest. So what we see under this baseline condition, which I should say is the same time period for which our model was calibrated, and our calibration matched very closely to measured data, that under this baseline condition, essentially you have temperatures that are supportive of the juvenile growth and rearing temperature requirement in about 3 miles of the Shasta River, and that in the lower reaches of the Shasta River, temperatures are above 24 degrees Celsius, which as an instantaneous temperature is seen as lethal for salmonids. So we then began to evaluate the role that different factors play in affecting temperature in the Shasta River. and we developed what we called our Master One scenario. And that scenario evaluated two factors.
You to have these laid out. One of the issues that came up in a couple of comments was the link between Dwinelle Dam and the lack of Fist Passage in the upper watershed. We responded that, yes, we felt that it was important for both the Water Board and Fish and Game to be involved, and we intend to coordinate with them. Issues relative to public trust and your responsibilities, we feel that you are aware of your public trust responsibilities and that you're taking them very seriously. Some requests to consider focusing the TMDL on coho. We elected deliberately to focus on salmonids in general. Volunteerism is still in front of us as an issue. Some saying, please continue it, it's important to make it work. Others saying, it's not stringent enough. And finally, issues related to pH, temperature, DO, and nutrients, and how they relate with the model and the processes in play. Those were also given responses in our comments, but again, we really feel that the focus of your direction and our focus on response to comments was the flow issues. And so with that, I'm going to turn over for the technical presentation to Matt St. John.
Thanks, Ollie. Chairman Massey, members of the board, and members of the public, good afternoon. So I'm going to briefly summarize the our findings of our technical analysis for the TMDL with a specific focus on the role of flow in the temperature TMDL. And in consideration of the role of flow in the Shasta River watershed temperature TMDL, I think it's really important to study the wording of the narrative temperature objective for our region, as it is stated in part on this slide. But really, to boil it down, to summarize, our regional narrative water quality objective for temperature requires that there be no alteration of natural temperature, or alternatively, it allows alteration of natural temperatures as long as beneficial uses are protected to the satisfaction of you, our board. So in evaluating opportunities for compliance with our temperature objective in developing the temperature TMDL, our main analytical tool was the Tennessee Valley Authority River Modeling System model, and we went over this in more detail in the workshop and at the previous hearing, so I won't go over that again. What I will say is that the model was developed to represent and simulate temperature conditions as well as dissolved oxygen conditions in the Shasta River from the outlet of Dwinelle Dam to the mouth of the Shasta River flowing into the Klamath River. Shown here is the results of the baseline condition for our critical condition, which was a simulation period in late August of 2002. And we compare this to, shown in the dashed line, is the 18 degrees Celsius, which is the salmonid juvenile growth and rearing temperature requirement as developed by US EPA in 2003 in a document that was provided guidance to development of temperature objectives in the Pacific Northwest. So what we see under this baseline condition, which I should say is the same time period for which our model was calibrated, and our calibration matched very closely to measured data, that under this baseline condition, essentially you have temperatures that are supportive of the juvenile growth and rearing temperature requirement in about 3 miles of the Shasta River, and that in the lower reaches of the Shasta River, temperatures are above 24 degrees Celsius, which as an instantaneous temperature is seen as lethal for salmonids. So we then began to evaluate the role that different factors play in affecting temperature in the Shasta River. and we developed what we called our Master One scenario. And that scenario evaluated two factors, shade and irrigation tailwater return flows. With respect to shade, we represented in the model full site potential shade conditions in the Shasta River and key tributaries. And for irrigation return flow, we characterized return flows such that they resulted in zero net increase in temperature. And it resulted in the red line, which shows the maximum temperature results for this Master One scenario. What's gained under this Master One scenario when compared to the baseline condition is now that approximately 7 miles of the Shasta River have a temperature regime that are suitable for salmonids during the juvenile growth and rearing life stage. Staff finds that this condition represented in the Master One scenario is not protective of beneficial uses, particularly not protective of the most sensitive beneficial use, that being the cold freshwater habitat. Given that, we felt it necessary to look at the third factor, which we had identified as affecting temperatures in the Shasta River watershed, the third being flow. So this scenario, which we called the water quality compliance scenario, included the first two factors representing site potential shade and, again, irrigation return flow, and then added in 45 CFS of cold water as dedicated flow. And in the case of this scenario, that 45 CFS came from the Big Springs Creek complex. The result of that scenario is that you have a temperature regime whereby temperatures meet or close to meet the juvenile rearing threshold for nearly 25 miles of the Shasta River downstream of Twinell Dam. We thought that it was important to evaluate this water quality compliance scenario, the results of the water quality compliance scenario, at specific temperature compliance points. And those are what are shown in the black lines, black arrows. And these temperature compliance points are the downstream, the location of a reach at the downstream end of known juvenile salmonid rearing habitat in the Shasta River. Now, it's important. I want to note that there were several commenters in this latest public comment period that identified that the water quality compliance scenario resulted in temperatures that were above the juvenile rearing threshold in essentially downstream of River Mile 9, which is, for all intents and purposes, is the Shasta River Canyon. We, staff, acknowledge that our analysis demonstrates that further temperature reductions could be achieved, particularly in the Shasta, in the canyon reach, but this could only be achieved by additional increase of dedicated cold water in-stream flow. It's our position, it's our finding, that the water quality compliance scenario supports the cold water beneficial use and therefore meets and attains the temperature objective. So to look at this a little bit further, I think it's useful to evaluate, again, the temperature objective by considering these three factors that affect temperature in the Shasta River. So those three factors are shade, tailwater, and flow. And in the middle column, we're looking at the suite of conditions that would result in a natural temperature of the Shasta River watershed. For shade, this would mean full site potential shade throughout the watershed, no return of irrigation tailwater returns, and a full natural flow regime. An altered natural temperature, but one which protects beneficial uses, includes full site potential shade with regard to irrigation tailwater returns, no net temperature increase to receiving waters, and for flow includes an addition of 45 CFS of dedicated cold water in-stream flow. CFR 130.7 states that TMDLs must result in attainment of water quality standards throughout the year under critical conditions. In this case, the water quality standard is, of course, the temperature objective and the related beneficial uses. It is staff's position that the science is clear, the science is straightforward. Temperatures that are protective of all beneficial uses in the Shasta River can be achieved, but only by including a dedicated cold water in-stream flow in the temperature TMDL equation. All TMDLs include allocations, and for the temperature TMDL, we assign temperature reductions to the source categories affecting temperature, in this case shade, tailwater, and flow. For shade, the allocation was full site potential shade. Irrigation return flows, the allocation is no net increase. And for flow, it is a reduction in maximum daily temperatures at the temperature compliance points. Now, just to conclude my portion of the presentation, at the May 17th board hearing, several of you asked for clarification regarding the flows that represent or reflect baseline flow conditions and flows that represent a natural flow condition. And that's what this last slide attempts to show. The first column shows unimpaired flows, and these are estimates by the California Department of Water Resources. And essentially they are the measured flows, but adding in the consumptive use. It's an average over the period of 1945 through 2004. The middle column is the existing baseline flow. That is the flow that was run under our baseline condition for the existing condition of the model. And then the right-hand column shows the flow at the mouth under the water quality compliance scenario. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. David Leland. Samantha. This is Samantha Olson.
Staff thinks my presentation's boring, I think. They want to skip over me. Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Samantha Olson. I'm staff counsel for the North Coast Water Board. And my presentation's on the Q drive. At the hearing last month on this item, Vice Chair Corbett proposed some language to the resolution that was meant to simply detail water jurisdiction in the state of California. And it prompted many comments. Many commenters supporting the resolution language and the underlying flow measure, many comments opposing the resolution measure and the flow measure and the TMDL. So I thought it would be worthwhile to spend a few minutes walking through the range of discretion that the regional board has to consider flow. There's many approaches to take, and so we can be very clear on what the Shasta TMDL flow measure actually does. And there's two areas where the regional board has discretion to consider low flows, and it's TMDLs. The first, the first is in the technical TMDL portion that Matt St. John was just speaking about. And the second is really in the implementation plan portion of the TMDL. And both of these areas, depending on the specific wording in your basin plan amendment, will effectuate what impact, if any, the basin plan will have on any water right. Now, in the technical portion of the TMDL, and every TMDL flow is already considered in determining the assimilative capacity of the water and seasonal variation. So there's already a built-in flow component to every TMDL. But the second portion of the technical TMDL involves determining reductions of sources that contribute reductions in the load allocation so to achieve water quality standards. And here is an area where there is discretion. And there's a full range, depending on a case-by-case scenario on your given TMDL, often not mentioning flow here is perfectly appropriate. A lot of TMDLs, this is not an issue. Low flows are not exasperating the condition. And so it'll be silent, and then the next step would be to call out a flow or recommend a flow as a way to provide an alternative to a discharge-dependent regulation. So in other words, you provide an option if prohibiting a discharge would be not feasible or too expensive. You have this option to increase the flow, and so that is useful. And then the next step up is also helps inform and assist other entities, and if they're trying to solve water quality problems, it again allows a range of options for implementation to achieve water quality standard. And then all the way up to the most stringent application here would be to specify a flow and promulgate a flow objective. Now, typically in TMDLs, we are not creating new objectives. We're interpreting objectives that already exist in the basin plan. But certainly in the basin planning process, the regional board is free to promulgate new objectives and has done so in the past. And as I stated, staff told me that my presentation was sort of boring, so I tried to distill this down to some basics. But if you need more specifics on any of these areas, feel free to let me know. So in the second section where there is discretion on how to implement a flow measure is really in the implementation plan. As you know, California law requires an implementation plan that details the actions necessary to reach water quality objectives, a timeline, and a monitoring program. And so in drafting the implementation plan, you have the option to do nothing, and I submit that this would not be an option if you don't have alternatives to reach water quality compliance. You could make a recommendation to a non-regulatory entity, and that could be with or without a flow number. You could make a recommendation to the state water board with or without a flow number. Or the most stringent, which would be to promulgate a flow objective and include an implementation directive to the state board to do something with water rights. And then finally, this incentive-based approach where you would link the flow to a discharge prohibition to provide an option. You either prohibit the discharge or provide the flow. And that approach has been taken in Region 5. The third and fourth bullets there really are the ones that start getting into the water right realm. Regional board staff has been very clear that it's the State Water Board Division of Water Rights that has jurisdiction to reallocate any water right. And so I would counsel that if we were thinking about doing those two, we would want to consult with the State Water Board and the Division of Water Rights very early on in the process, considering that the State Water Board has the ultimate authority to how to decide on how these issues will be decided. And so and also they must approve our TMDLs and basin plan amendments. And so it would behoove us to speak with them and collaborate with them well in advance. I want to go back to that last slide. Is there a way to do that? Is there a way to reverse it? Can we go back one slide? So what is the Shasta doing here? Can you go back one more slide? I apologize. On the range of flow-related load allocations, we are really in the recommend mode with a flow number and perhaps informing and assisting. And on the implementation, we are in the recommendation to a non-regulatory entity with a flow number with built-in flexibility for other alternatives. And so these next series of slides I've put on the actual flow measure itself, so the slide's busy, but I'm going to just walk through a couple components of that. And so in Table 4 of the action plan, the flow measure requests that water diverters employ water management practices that result in an increased dedicated cold water in-stream flow in the Shasta River. And then we recommend the participation in and implementation of applicable flow-related measures outlined in the various fish and game programs and the Shasta River RCD. This approach is consistent with the overarching approach to this TMDL that is trying to support the ongoing collaborative efforts already going on in this watershed. There's about three or four slides with this flow measure. And so within 2 years, and again in four, we request a report on the measures taken to increase the dedicated cold in-stream flow by 45 CFS or alternative flow regime that achieves the same temperature reductions. We got a lot of comments objecting to the 45 CFS, and I think it relates to this issue of whether there's a flow requirement or a flow recommendation. Mr. Chair, question?
No, I'm just...
And so I'm hoping through this presentation that concern goes away if it's very clear that this is not an objective, and there is, and I'm going to get to the implementation, but there is no implementing language directing the State Water Board to reallocate water rights in accordance with this number. Nonetheless, we want to make this patently clear, so staff is proposing the following language. This recommended flow measure does not alter or reallocate water rights in the Shasta River watershed, nor bind the State Water Board Division of Water Rights in any water right decision. The next section deals with coordination with various agencies. And then on the consequence for failure to implement the recommended flow is really a reassessment period in 5 years where the regional board preserves its option to recommend at that time to the State Water Board that it do something with water rights. That's really the only implementing language in this measure. Staff feels it struck the right balance here in having a flow recommendation versus promulgating flow objectives and directing the State Water Board to open a water rights proceeding or some other reallocation for several reasons. The first being that a collaborative solution could engage all water diverters, including groundwater and riparian, and because low flows are caused by all water diverters should participate in the solutions. Secondly, this approach could avoid a lot of unnecessary procedural burdens. I come from working for the Division of Water Rights, and water right proceedings tend to go on for a very long time. They're very costly and sometimes don't result in what we're trying to achieve. So the third reason is if we were going to promulgate actual flow objectives, we'd need more information and we'd want to consider the entire Klamath Basin. And finally, the collaborative approach will allow for creative problems. That's assuming that parties take advantage of the opportunity. And David Leland's going to follow this presentation and talk about some of those opportunities, unless you have any questions. David.
Thank you. Mr. Cochran.
Samantha, could we get a copy of your presentation? We didn't.
Yes.
Good afternoon.
Chairman Massey, members of the board, and members of the public. My name is David Leland. I'm the lead in the TMDL development unit. Is the microphone on? Are we recording, Michelle?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to follow up on Sam's last slide there and talk about some of the opportunities that are available. We've talked about the in-stream flow goal here. There's been a lot of concern about this, including concerns expressed by you that the burden of meeting this goal may fall disproportionately on a few diverters, and I wanted to speak in particular to those concerns in my presentation today. Let's start with an ownership map. of the watershed. The ownership in the Shasta watershed is mixed federal, state, local, and private, with the forested, more mountainous areas in both public and private forest lands, and the lower elevation areas mostly in private ownership. So we're looking at the focus of concern with respect to flows is the these private lands, and more specifically, the irrigated lands within those private lands. Just to point out a few key features here. Greg, can you go back one for me, please? The Shasta River runs from south to north to its confluence with the Klamath. Parks Creek is a major tributary to the Shasta that has a inner tie here with the Shasta for diversion into Lake Shastina. Montague Water Conservation District's diversion is here, and their district lands are mostly out here in the northern part of the watershed. There are other irrigation districts as well. So the area that we're talking about here are those areas, the portion of the privately held agricultural lands that can be roughly characterized as the area between the easterly delivery ditches and the westerly ditches. So we're looking at kind of this area in here. The California Department of Water Resources, in its 2005 water plan update, which I have a copy of here, identifies over 30 water resource management strategies for better matching multiple competing and often conflicting demands for water with limited water resources. The subset that I present here represents those strategies that, in my view, are most applicable to the water quality and water quantity challenges being faced in the Shasta. Let me expand on a few of these. There are many opportunities for doing more with less when it comes to agricultural production, including changing the method of irrigation, lining ditches, recovering tailwater, and improving monitoring and feedback capabilities to benefit system operations. In fact, for 32 important California crops, production per unit of applied water increased 38% in the 20-year period between 1980 and 2000. There are also a wide range of system reoperation options. For example, Lake Shasta has a temperature control device to improve water temperatures in the Sacramento for the support of fisheries resources. As another example, the Bureau of Reclamation employs risk management strategies in both its Klamath and Trinity River operations to address seasonal precipitation patterns through year-type operations. And there are a variety of other options as well. A number of agricultural land stewardship actions can affect water use and availability. These types of strategies and others that I have not covered in detail address what I call the physical part of the puzzle. There are also economic and legal aspects to this. Economic incentives is one of the other strategies identified by the Department of Water Resources. There are a variety of incentives that are available to support adoption of new management strategies. This agency is perhaps most familiar with grants and loans, since we have some direct responsibility for administering grant and loan programs, but there are other options as well. On the legal side, the State Water Code provides legal mechanisms for transferring and dedicating water to, among other uses, water quality improvement, and can be applied in coordination with the water savings generated through the other strategies that I've noted. In fact, in 2001, over 1.25 million acre-feet of water was transferred, with 200,000 of that directed towards environmental programs. A recent example of a transfer that's in the works is on Battle Creek, on the east side of the Sacramento drainage, where Pacific Gas and Electric is transferring rights to the Department of Fish and Game for dedicated cold water in-stream flow to support Chinook and Steelhead populations. In the Scott Valley, the idea of a water trust is being explored, which in effect combines all three of the elements that I'm talking about. It provides physical water with a legal structure and a funding mechanism that will enable achievement of both water quality and fishery benefits. So the question is, can these ideas be employed in the Shasta? The physical layout will allow it, though additional infrastructure would probably be required. The issue here in part is operating the irrigation systems currently extant in the Shasta watershed, more as a single system. There's already a link between Parks Creek and Lake Shastina as an example of an infrastructure improvement that would allow improved water management. A link between the Montague Water Conservation District main canal and Big Springs, for example, would allow any water savings generated anywhere in the Montague Water Conservation District to be applied at Big Springs, given appropriate water transfers. I imagine that there are other opportunities like this as well. So the question is, are these just a bunch of pie-in-the-sky ideas, or do we actually are they actually being used? All of the strategies that I have noted are currently being used to solve water resource challenges in California. Most of them are being used in the Scott and Shasta watersheds by at least some irrigators. In fact, the specific measures related to most of these strategies are already included in the Scott-Shasta pilot program that was developed and endorsed by members of the community and included in the Department of Fish and Game Coho Recovery Strategy. If these and other strategies were more widely employed, the flow target we are recommending could be met while maintaining agricultural production. So in summary, the puzzle pieces are there for a solution that combines a healthy agricultural community with good water quality and support for the full range of beneficial uses. We have lots of tools in the toolbox. We have solutions that do not require reopening adjudications, and we have the potential for all irrigators to contribute to the solution of the problem. But how do we put the puzzle together? I would submit that leadership, both public and private, is the key ingredient from here. That concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Leland. Do we have any questions for Mr. Leland? Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, you mentioned in the next to last, well, it's in the map where you were considering a connection between Lake Shastina and Big Springs. Is that a physical connection, or is that a water paper transfer?
It would be both of those is what would be required. Physical connection with appropriate legal mechanisms backing that up.
So there's not a physical connection?
It's my understanding that there is not now, although there may be someone here who could correct me on that.
You're fortunate nobody behind you stood up.
Well, if there is, that would be good news. We'd be further along than I had anticipated.
Any other questions, Mr. Leland?
Thanks very much.
Thank you. I'm assuming that concludes the staff presentation. We will take approximately a 7-minute break, and before we run away, I did notice that the chair of the State Water Resources Control Board is here, Ms. Tam Doduck. We'll take approximately seven, yes.
Do you want to introduce Mr. Charles Hoppen?
Okay.
Also new to the State Board.
Also a member of the State Board, and I'm sorry, Mr. Hoppen, but I did not recognize you, largely because we've never met. But welcome to the North Coast. We'll take about a 7-minute break, Mr. Corbett.
Yeah, before we take the break, I just want to compliment staff on incorporating the board's clarification of the flows, adding Chinook as a species, since irrigated ag and Chinook are key beneficial uses. Including the cultural is downriver, although I think after the State Board hearing we have that red flag that we probably in the quadrennial review need to go deeper into that. And I also appreciate the strengthening of the conditional waiver language and did want to note that the board had always left open WDRs in its absence. So thank you.
Okay, we'll take about a 7-minute break. We will be right back.
Cover for a minute. Maybe I'll sit in for a little while.
There's access, wireless access here.
This is where the next 32 people. Yeah.
No. That'll get you on the internet.
Right. There must be some other way.
But not prohibited.
Okay, if we can get ourselves back.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Anderson?
If I could, I follow up. I had talked to Matt earlier, and over break, he said he's prepared to answer a question I posed to him. I'll let him just come up and wing it, or I'll try to. But it gets to the compliance points. We've seen a number of times in places the areas where the temperature would be evaluated, and when I compared some of the documentation, I had a question regarding that, and maybe it's simpler just for Matt to explain his answer rather than me to pose a question, but I can take it either way.
Well, I'm happy to. Is this on? Is this on now? Okay.
Would you please re-identify yourself, please?
Happy to. Matt St. John, Regional Board staff. So the issue that...
And I'm looking at a document that's the... In the board packet, page 6-17... Where the maximum stream temperature reductions attributed to flow increases for maximum temperature 1.5 degrees Celsius, 1.2 degrees Celsius, and 2.1 degrees Celsius at Three River Mile locations.
Is the copy that you're looking at, is it the clean copy or the strike-through underline? Because the page numbers vary.
It's under 6.5. 1-4.
Yeah, that's a good way to do it.
Okay.
It's so, actually the paragraph right above 6.5.1.4.
Right. Okay, so the question that you, as I understood it, that you were asking is how were these specific temperatures, which represent temperature reductions at the temperature compliance points, calculated? Is that correct?
Correct.
So the simplest way is to demonstrate it is to turn to table 6.6. And if you look at this terribly complicated table, but look at the right hand, the three columns at the right, and specifically look at the water quality compliance.
Back.
Okay. I'm in table.
A couple of pages prior.
Table 6.6. Back.
Page 614.
So for public's benefit, we're talking about table 6.6 of the staff report. And if you look at the very right-hand column, which is presenting the maximum modeled differences in temperature compared to the August baseline, if you look at the water quality compliance scenario, and let's for as a point of discussion, look at the compliance point called Salmon Heaven. So it's the second to last row in that first block. If you subtract, take 4.82, which is the maximum temperatures at the under the water quality compliance scenario, you subtract 2.68 from that, because 2.68, I'm sorry, is the middle column there, which is the master one scenario. Master one scenario, as I went over in my presentation, is the scenario that looked at just shade and irrigation tailwater return flows. So if you subtract 2.68 from 4.82, you get 2.14. So that is the amount of the total temperature reduction that is due only to the increased flow of 45 CFS.
And so the only difference between Master 1 and water quality compliance is the 45 CFS?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, that answers your question, Mr. Anderson. We are going to adhere pretty strictly to the three-minute rule. We have 32 speaker cards, and so we are going to go both quickly and efficiently. And we will start with Mr. Joe Dillon from National Marine Fishers.